Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Business Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Wall Street was down for a second week on stronger than expected inflation as the U.S. economy keeps roaring along. That's going to likely delay Federal Reserve rate cuts that have been widely expected on capital markets. A new survey shows supply chains are unlikely to normalize for between 1 and 3 years. Another Boeing whistleblower accuses the giant of taking potentially dangerous shortcuts on its 787 jetliner. When all of this spending, whether in the United States or in Europe, are going to pay dividends in the output of weapons that both Western nations as well as Ukraine can use, Japan's importance as a security partner in the Pacific, as well as an industrial superpower, and an update on the Ukraine war. Joining me today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Securities, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafia of the Aerodynamic Advisory Consultancy. Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you on. Ron, start us off, walk us through the week on the street and how the Defense and Aerospace Group performed. Obviously, economy is roaring along, but unfortunately, inflation is running hotter than expected, which in turn then has, everybody wondering, when the Federal Reserve is and if the Federal Reserve is going to be cutting borrowing rates, as the Fed had originally said, assuming the right economic circumstances are in play. Get us started on this, and Sash, look forward to getting your update as well.
Yeah, so I mean, the Fed hasn't cut interest rates, right? So the worry is, because inflation's stickier or maybe getting a little hotter, when will the Fed cut rates or if the Fed will cut rates? I mean, it's the same debate. I mean, it kind of drives me bananas, right, to be honest with you.
I'm running out of different ways of asking the same exact question.
Right. But that being
but
said,
it was two down weeks in a row, right? Yeah, and no, inflation no. Running hotter.
Yes. So that being said, the S&P was off about 1.5%. And then if you look across our coverage group, thematically, defense did better than commercial, although most everything was down, although some things did outperform the market. My core coverage, really the only name that was up on the week was Northrop, and it was up about 0.5%. The worst performer of the major stocks was Boeing. It was down 7.5%. And then, the typical kind of defensey names were down about 1%. And then some commercial names were down more than that. If you look at crude oil, given what's going on in the Middle East, you would think it would have gone up. It was pretty steady week over week. WTI was hovering around 85. Brent crude was hovering around 90. The 10-year yield, about 4.5. That's where it was a week ago. Now, what did change, however, the VIX index did shoot up, right? And again, that's that measurement right. of kind of fear in the market. It's around 18, and not that long ago on one of these podcasts it was like 12. That fear is kind of, risk aversion is starting to build in the market. Kind of notably this week, given that it was down about 7.5%, year to date, Boeing is the number two worst performing stock in the S&P 500, which is a notable, not a great honor, but a notable thing. I think that's where we were.
And we're going to come back around, obviously, delve deeper into the multiple Boeing storylines as we do, right? I mean, most important company really in the ecosystem. Sash, your sense on European markets, right? I mean, sometimes what happens here, it's a little bit like the weather goes over to the other side of the ocean. How did the group perform overall?
There's a lot of volatility this week. And the sector overall in Europe ended the week down 1% and a bit. Civil, this is the interesting thing. Civil was down 2.5%, defense down 1%. But earlier on in the week, there was what I think I euphemistically described as a competitor downgrade. An investment bank took a view that defense stocks in Europe were overvalued, had run too far too fast, whatever you want to say. And, the defense stocks really got hammered for a day or so. And then actually, week on week, most of them recovered. The only ones that were down on the week really badly was Leonardo and Saab, down, both down about sort of 4 or 5%. But you know, remember, Saab's up 330% since the invasion of Ukraine. Leonardo's up 244%. They're both up 50% this year. So yeah, it's very understandable why there should be a bit of profit taking. But I think what this does is to highlight the sort of the debate at the moment about how to value defense stocks in Europe. One view says, well, they're, you know, the stocks are expensive relative to historic multiples because the stocks have raced up, but the earnings have not yet caught up with that. That's very much the case. The other view is that actually what we're going through is a once in a generation, once in a lifetime rearmament in Europe. It's going to be bigger, longer than anybody has living experience of. And frankly, what happens in year two, which is where we are at the moment, is pretty immaterial compared to the scale of the rearmament process over a decade, possibly, probably a decade. But you know, this was definitely a week where the former argument held more sway than the latter argument. And it profit taking does occur even in bull markets. But it's, you know, it's quite interesting that by the end of the week, most of the defense stocks have caught up again.
And when, let me just parenthetically ask you this, right? Because you wrote a great note on Saab and you just mentioned, right, that we are in a bull market and the company is up. A lot of other companies are up as well. So is Rheinmetall and others. When are we going to see, because I want to sort of touchstone this to the conversation we're going to have a little bit later in the program, toward the end of the program on Ukraine. But when is it we're going to see actual deliveries significantly rise? Because if you look at it in the United States, I mean, Russia is cranking out more stuff. And we as the West and the United States kind of really aren't, except maybe on artillery shells where the ball is moving a little bit more quickly. Give us a little bit of an update on, you know, okay, so we're in this bull market. When are the outputs coming out of these pipes? At the end of the day, in anything that could be considered meaningful, if, for example, you're Ukraine and fighting for your life, or Poland and better trying to defend itself?
We are already seeing orders come in. We see book-to-bills are, for the early cycle companies, book-to-bills are off the scale. You know, book-to-bill last year for Saab, was, you know, 1.5 times. It was about the same as that for Rheinmetall as well. These are phenomenally strong. No, sorry, I apologize. Yeah, 1.5 times. These are phenomenally strong book to bills. So that reflects orders that were placed last year. We're starting to see rates go up very, very materially. Artillery shells, you're absolutely right, but missiles as well. Missiles take longer, but missile production is rising, particularly at, I suppose, what you call the light end of the market, anti-armor, but particularly anti-aircraft. And I think this year we will see European missile production generally up between 25 and 50%, slightly depending on the nature. When have we ever seen that before? Now, here's the catch. It's from a very, very low level. Most European missile producers are producing tens of missiles a month when they should or need to be producing hundreds of missiles a month. But if you've been starved of funding, orders, any sort of payment by your government for capacity over the last 15 years, it is hard to ramp up. But you know, it is starting to go up, not as much as the poor Ukrainians want. But I think one of the interesting things, if you know, we sort of track orders that are placed by countries, but where it is reported as an undisclosed European nation. And what that means is country A or country G, let's say, is placing an order with defense businesses in its own country for equipment which will be delivered direct to Ukraine, or country S is paying for a whole load of anti-armor weapons. And those orders have actually been, you know, pretty consistent now for about 15 months. And when they come, they're big. They are, you know, billion euros plus. And they're coming, not quite at a quarterly rate, but for each company, but pretty nearly. So I think stuff is starting to happen. But the problem is big anti-aircraft weapons, big anti-aircraft missiles, are nearly a US monopoly. Patriot is the weapon that the Ukrainians need. And there are very few of them in Europe to be given. And therefore, they have to be built in the US. And the US lines are moving quite slow.
Unfortunately, for a whole variety of reasons, including the fact that Congress can't get its act straight, right? I mean, we're 6 months into the fiscal year, and Congress has just passed an appropriation. Richard, hold on 1 second, because I want you to start the inflation part of the discussion, but Ron has his hand up. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, so one point that I to follow on to what Sash said, and this was, I was in Europe this week meeting with clients, and one thing I didn't realize was pointed out to me, and you know, this is interesting, maybe not really all that relevant, but it is interesting. Year to date, Rheinmetall's actually outperformed NVIDIA, right? NVIDIA, that's been this tech trade around AI, and Rheinmetall's outperformed it year to date. Now, if you look on 2 years, 3 years, NVIDIA's crushed it. But just to give you a sense of maybe why some investors are saying things are overdone or not, I mean, that's maybe one window at which people look at things.
All I would point out, right? I mean, last week we had the Navy League's Sea Air Space Conference, and all I'll tell you is the United States Navy is investing, and its industrial base is investing a huge amount of money in building up shipbuilding industrial skills. To be able to deliver ships much faster in the future, deliver maintenance much faster. So there is really a strategic shift that's really underway for both new construction as well as improved ultimate support. Richard, inflation impact. Outlays are at a near all-time high, but inflation is also running a lot higher than folks expected. I spoke to a few senior U.S. military officers, all of whom noted that actually the department's buying power is down. They, you know, budgeting, I think, for like 2.1% inflation, but it's actually running double that, right? What's the impact we ought to be considering in sort of reduced buying power, right? I mean, there's a big debate about whether we should be spending more money or not, but then that's, you know, hitting fiscal and you know, deficit reduction triggers. That's likely to get worse in, you know, whatever happens in November. Kind of walk us through your sense on what the impact, lingering impact, industrial impact, and eventually, right, commercial aviation and defense consumer impact from these inflationary figures.
You know, there's a number of things going on here. I think, first of all, people are focused on that CPI number, you know, the 3.5, 3.8, what have you, 3.5, and of course, core inflation and all related indices. But in reality, you know, aerospace and defense has its own inflation number, and it's considerably higher for obvious reasons. When demand is off the charts for both civil and military, you're just going to have higher inflation both for labor and material. So, you know, what that number is, I can't tell you. It hasn't come out yet, but it's going to be higher than 3.5, that's for sure. So buying power is eroding faster than that 3.5 number, especially when procurement funding is effectively flat and probably going to stay flat given that rather paralyzed Congress. You know, so buying power is not going to get any better. And that's unfortunate. Meanwhile, you also have the problem of allowable inflation for fixed price contracts. A lot of companies have varying degrees of exposure to fixed price contracts. Of course, some of Ron's notes have, you know, highlighted what percent and everything like that. But, you know, and very often it's 40-50%. And in cases like Boeing, it's higher even. And high profile cases like the B-21 LRIP contract, it's, you know, pretty substantial. And it's safe to say that there's going to be an exceeding of allowable bands for, you know, inflationary increases in fixed price contracts. So people are going to take a hit in terms of margins in some cases, that I think is another factor to watch out for.
I should point out, right, that this is also a challenge for the U.S. Air Force's Sentinel contract, right, on the ground-based strategic deterrence. Deterrent, which is ending up costing a lot more money than anybody thought, given that it was awarded before COVID, and or at least, you know, early in COVID, if I recall correctly, or maybe just before COVID. And then we saw, obviously, everything that happened since then. Ron and Sash, you guys want to take a bite at the inflation apple? And Ron, maybe if you could also tell us a little bit about the survey you conducted in partnership with our mutual dear friend, Joanna Speed of Aeroland, who is the organizer of the aerospace event. There was a really fascinating supplier trends survey that you guys did, right? I mean, showing, you know, that the supply chain is not likely to normalize for anything between 1 and 3 years. Talk about inflation impact and sort of the supplier chain, given that suppliers are kind of having their moment and are going to be eating into, let's be honest, the margin at the big companies.
Yeah, so I mean, one thing I want to bring up, and I think this is really important, and people are forgetting it for some reason because maybe it's being overshadowed by other things. IAM 751 is currently negotiating with Boeing. I believe, Richard, correct me if I'm wrong, their contract runs out on September 12th. And they're asking for a bunch of different things. And they currently have a fair amount of leverage, like a lot of leverage. So they want a greater than 40% pay increase over a 3-year period. They'd like to get their pension back. They want the next airplane built in Seattle. They don't want to lose another airplane like they did 787 to another production site. We'll see where that all goes. If I were a betting man, my bet is they have a strike. Anyway, the point is, that's all inflationary, you know, very specific to Boeing, very specific to the industry. So to Richard's point, inflation in the aerospace and defense industry is very real and higher than you would see it maybe outside of the industry. Then on the supplier survey, maybe just kind of you hit one of the real key points that, you know, things aren't quite normalizing yet. And then another one was, you know, kind of across the supply chain. We asked the question, you know, is there kind of room for a third OEM? And I think broadly everybody said, yeah, there is. So, I mean, that's an interesting point to debate. Maybe not academic. We'll see what happens with some of these more interesting younger companies like JetZero. We'll see if Embraer ends up doing something. It seems like broadly, even the supply chain is starting to lose some patience with Boeing because they have to run their businesses. And I think it's broadly recognized that if there's a third supplier that can do, you know, large civil aircraft, that's probably pretty good for everybody.
And the consensus is that they have to launch a new airplane as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that's it, what's interesting. Across the board now, you hear, I mean, kind of in my little, you know, investor orbit. I think, you know, in industry, for sure, there's broad recognition that they have to do one. And I think even now in the investor community, there's broad recognition that, yeah, they have to do a plane. And we can talk about that in great length, you know, later or another time. But, you know, kind of that has all kinds of implications on, you know, their financial outlook, right? Because what it'll cost, you know, is it $15 billion, $20 billion, who knows? But you know, that will impact a lot of different things.
Indeed. Sash, your sense on inflationary pressures and how it's going to be affecting both governments as well as suppliers to government, and as well as on the commercial side of the business.
Yeah, I mean, on the commercial side of the business, the most obvious example of this is Airbus is facing a strike at the Mirabel site in Canada, where they produce the A220. And you know, I think what's source for the unions in Seattle is definitely source for the unions over the border in Canada as well. I've been surprised that there's not been as much as much union pressure coming out in Europe. Although specifically within Airbus, I think the fact that the company maintained its staff levels at rather higher than happened over the other side of the Atlantic, and they did quite a lot of smart things in terms of furloughs and short time working and so forth, means that there isn't quite the pent up resentment in Europe that there is clearly of Boeing in Seattle at the moment. Where inflation really worries me actually is in defense, because if a defense budget is only growing a couple of percent per annum, which if a defense budget was set, you know, last year, the year before, that's probably what was put into the numbers. There's no way that covers inflation. I completely agree with Rich on this. Inflation in this industry runs higher than stated inflation rates for consumers and so forth. Inflation rates in defense sometimes are running at least twice the published rates at the moment. So defense industries have got a real, defense ministries have got real problems at the moment. Paradoxically, I think those countries that are starting to realize that they need to up their defense spending to 2% of GDP, and frankly higher than that, that process deals with a fair amount of the short-term inflationary pressures, even if it means they can't buy as much as they wanted. But it's the sort of the stick in the mud, which tends to be in the west and southwest of Europe, UK in particular, France to a degree, actually, Spain, where defence spending isn't going up that much, or certainly the published numbers aren't yet. They're the ones which are where the ministers are having real problems dealing with inflation, because quite a lot of service contracts in particular will have an inflation linked clause in.
Let's shift gears. We've got a lot to cover, and I want to go to the obligatory Boeing portion of the conversation. Richard, start us off. Unfortunately, a revelation of more problems. This time, a whistleblower is accusing the company of taking shortcuts on 787 production that he argues will shorten the service life of the plane and make it vulnerable to accidents, jeopardizing the flying public. The problems with the company were sort of seen to be limited to the 737 MAX line. And I'm not saying that 787 has ever been a walk in the park, right? Complicated, long development, a lot of teething problems, and the company pretty much didn't get a handle on some of those until very recently. What does this new revelation mean? Because it has, again, impacted the company's stock price.
Yeah, if the 787 was ever a walk in the park, I don't want to walk in that particular park. I mean, it's a good jet and all, but my God, what a nightmare. I mean, you know, look, there's a number of issues here. I understand the high profile nature of these concerns. First of all, why now? Why did they suddenly come out with this whistleblower? He could have gone public before. Second of all, I guess there's the big point. You go back 3 years, I'm thinking, four, and you look at the long laundry list of unpleasantries in the production process that caused the FAA to revoke Boeing's ability to certify 787 production jets. It's unpleasant, right? I mean, it's a really long list. I went back and looked at it from, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, actually. And pandemic time, it causes things to dilate. But you know, it is ugly, right? And if those were not addressed, or if those couldn't be remedied post-production, then yeah, there's got to be concerns. But that list is known. It's been out there. It was published. Right. So I understand the concern. But again, I've got big questions about this. I understand.
So are you suggesting this is linked to the union negotiations, perhaps? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, not necessarily. I don't think it is union negotiations. I mean, I understand how this shines a light on the issue of Charleston versus Puget Sound, for sure. But is that what's at work here? No. I mean, it could be somebody who's been waiting to come out with a why waiting. Just amassed a bunch of evidence and decided now is the time. I honestly don't know. But all I know is that the laundry list of unpleasantries came out a couple of years ago and was either remedied, or if not remedied, then we need to look into it right away.
I want to go to Ron and Sash in just a moment. But first, a quick word from our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by Bell HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Ron, you want to take it away? Because, I mean, every once in a while, whistleblowers, it's hard position to be in, right? I mean, still some questions about the last whistleblower and you know, whether or not he committed suicide. That's what people think it is. But apparently he told all of his friends that if anything happens to me, it's not suicide. I'm not a conspiracy theorist and don't want to get hounds running. I'm just saying that that appear, you know, there were some questions about that, which could make somebody think twice before they come out and whistleblow again. Anyway, just kind of walk us through what, more important, the reality of the allegations are at a time when the FAA is trying to get its arms around this. And more importantly, how Boeing has to respond to this ultimately, when people are already fundamentally asking questions about the safety of the company's products, to the point where even the president of the United States is making jokes about it, which is not where you want to be for somebody who's moving, you know, a billion, helping move a billion people around the world every year.
Yeah, so I fall in line with Richard in that I don't know, right? I mean, maybe there's meat on this bone, maybe there's not. But the fact is, this was raised and it has to be looked at and taken seriously given everything else that's happened, right? If production issues weren't in existence and everything was going swimmingly, it might be easier to say, oh, maybe there's something here, maybe not. But given the fact set that we have over the last 5 years, this has to be right. Taken seriously, independent of if there's meat on it or not. And could it be disruptive? Yeah, it could be. I mean, it just depends. Boeing still doesn't have they don't certificate the airplanes and they don't ticket them as they come off the line. The FAA does on both lines, still on the 737 and the 78. That's the reality of it. That it has to be taken serious and looked at. And you know, per Richard's comment, if there is something that is, you know, there, it will have to be addressed.
However disruptive, whatever next happens is probably less disruptive than losing a 787 that breaks up in the air.
Yeah, if there's something there, right? I mean, but that's
right. Assuming there's something there, yeah. And this guy didn't pull it straight out of his butt, you know, to try to get a little bit of attention. Sash, your sense on this, and I've got, you know, and I just want to compliment you on your great Boeing note, channeling the great Nigerian writer Chinua Achebe and his book Things Fall Apart. You know, give us your sense on you know, where the company is and the way out of it, because you addressed it in, you know, short, sweet, and to the point of a note.
The credit for our note is entirely to my colleague Nick Cunningham, who I think you know, wrote extremely well there. I'll just make one point about this week's disclosures, which is that all of this makes it very, very hard indeed, or at least it makes it very high risk for the Boeing board to appoint somebody who is a company insider as the next CEO, or somebody who has been a company insider, because somebody who has served in the company before is likely to be tied up in the defense deferred prosecution agreement with the DOJ, because they are likely to have been around and in a position of executive authority at that stage. So that I think the need for Boeing to appoint somebody who's been out of the company for some time and therefore is not tainted by the financial misjudgments that have occurred in terms of leveraging the company up, and has not been responsible for the commercial and production misjudgments in terms of focusing on cost at the expense of safety, is incredibly important. So I think that actually reduces the potential candidates list quite considerably. I don't think they can go back to, you know, for example, former CFO Greg Smith. I think that would be very, very high risk if something went wrong, really astonishingly high risk for the board if something went wrong there.
Indeed, and I should have flagged that to Nick. Richard, I mean, two Sash's point, and Ron, your take on this as well, right? Dave Calhoun is stepping down as chief executive pending the conclusion of the search, right? He's going to stay in the job. He's been on the board since 2009 and apparently wants to stay on the board. What does that potentially mean? I'm just going to give each of you an opportunity to weigh in on this briefly. I think Sash may have answered that question already, but just to give each one of you a bite at this apple.
Sash did a great job. But let me just double down on this. It's shockingly embarrassing that this is even an action item. Easily the worst CEO Boeing has ever had, perhaps one of the worst CEOs in aerospace and defense of all time, or indeed the possibly worst CEO ever. Certainly a list that I'm sure is more patched than I would know of. But the idea that he would stay on the board and continue to spout nonsense.
It's a very competitive field. I think we could work that one. But let's just say your position is he would be a contestant for a finalist position in that competition.
I think what distinguishes him is a campaign of outgoing CEO sabotage for the company. The idea that, you know, look, maybe now is not the perfect time to launch, but I believe they need to move towards it. Ron believes they should launch. We all agree new products are essential. And he's been out there saying not just that he wouldn't do anything this decade at all, but if they did, it would cost $50 billion, which is a number he deliberately fabricated. In other words, they'd be appointing someone to the board, or reappointing or whatever, someone to the board who is not just a very, very, very bad CEO indeed, but someone whose best interests are in the exact opposite of the company's best interest. And it would show that exactly nothing has changed in terms of corporate governance.
Ron?
Yeah, I mean, just a couple comments. I'm always amazed at some decisions that boards make. And there's always a confluence of factors. And so I don't know. I can't really guess what we're going to do.
It's up to the board to extend them or not. Right.
It's up to shareholders. Right. And, you know, then you know,
yeah, that's true.
There's a proxy vote. He's in the proxy document. There's a shareholder meeting. The board will suggest who should be voted for. Right. I mean, they could put you on the board. Right. I mean, just a shareholder vote. And shareholders typically follow what the board says to do. Why do they do that? Because many shareholders are passive shareholders, and a lot of equities today are traded in exchange traded funds where it isn't active, it's passive, and to the passive vote generally just kind of goes with what the company says. That's just sort of how it works. What the board does, I hope they do rational things. I can't, you know, we'll see what they do. But I can tell you what they need, right? I mean, they need someone who can win hearts and minds, somebody who has technical skill, someone who can work with labor, and someone that can, lead a team that's going to develop a new aircraft that will be around for another 30 to 40, maybe 50 years. So they got to do the right airplane, because if they do the wrong one, they got to live with it.
I think all four of us can agree that if tapped, we would be honored to serve in one capacity to try to help the company. Although I think that there are people who are at the company who would be able to do that. The question is whether or not they would be given the opportunity to do that. Let me very quickly, because I want to shift gears a little bit to Japan and the extraordinary agreements and extraordinary security role the country is standing up to play. I mean, always a cornerstone of America's relationship in the Pacific and role in the Pacific that's been growing. Speaking of CEO-driven news, former Spirit AeroSystems CEO Tom Gentile was tapped to succeed Nick Stanich as chief executive, and that's prompted a drop in the share price of Hexcel. Just really quickly, Sash, what are some of the messages that things like this sends, right? I mean, it led to some downgrades on the stock. It also led to investors, frankly, hammering, a company that's got a pretty good position in the market. I'm not trying to make this a judgment into Tom and how good of a guy he is or whatever else. Just you know, an observation of what it is we saw over the last week. Just real quick, your sense on that before we move on to Japan.
Well, I think when you get a CEO departing one role, you know, by no means in glory, let's be honest about that. You know, Mr. Gentile left Spirit in a very, very bad way. It is a real surprise when they get picked up for a, you know, for another similarly high profile CEO role, let alone this far. So I'm just very surprised at what the Hexcel board must have, you know, were thinking and looking for in that respect. I would have at least waited for the dust to settle at Spirit, and even if that, you know, ultimately means it's reabsorbed into Boeing, but to see how that process works and hence what the underlying value of Spirit is, because that's the test of a CEO. And so if the reabsorption of Spirit into Boeing and spinning out of bits of it to Airbus, which is what Airbus, if that happens at a lower share price than the market has been expecting, that will tell you that, you know, Spirit was not being run particularly well, I'll leave it at that, during the previous, you know, 3, 4, 5 years or so. So I think it's a, you know, Hexcel board, you know, it should be for them to explain to investors what they were thinking, what they are thinking, and what they were looking for.
Let me just real quickly go around the horn, because what I find fascinating is sort of what happens to Spirit, right? It looks like Boeing is the one who's going to be buying it, but then there are folks who are floating all sorts of other names, right, who are going to be doing this. Guillaume Faury, the Airbus chief executive, has gotten involved in this as well. A lot of permutations. Okay, so Boeing absorbs the North American side of the business. Where does the Airbus side of the business go? Does it go to BAE Systems? Does it go someplace else? Anyway, what, you know, the Belfast Aerostructures business that they've grown to be a nice operation. I mean, Sash, do you want to go on this, and we'll quickly go around the horn on you know, what are the dynamic factors in this? I mean, is this really kind of a broader bidding war, or is this? Because depending on who you talk to, it's either like a direct Boeing is taking it over, or, you know, boy, the company's in play. I don't know about that.
I wouldn't use the phrase the company's in play at all. I think Boeing may have to take Spirit over, which means the corporate Spirit itself. But change of control clauses are change of control clauses. You know, Boeing wouldn't be allowed anyway, and wouldn't want to be doing work for Airbus at the two plants, one in Belfast, one in the US. So Boeing would naturally want to get rid of those. Here's the problem: they're loss-making. Loss-making plants don't sell for very much, even to very, very you know, super focused strategic bidders.
Right.
And the way I read Guillaume Faury's messaging this week was, was the effect of, we may have to take the plants, but you, Boeing Spirit, will have to pay us to take them away. And that adds to the total value, or, you know, the total enterprise value of Spirit, which then starts to damage the equity value of Spirit. But I think it's not a bidding war in the sense that people want these plants and are going to pay more and more and more for it. It's more like Dutch auction, where the price is going down each time, because there's no, you know, nobody else is going to want the Boeing bits until they know what the terms and conditions and so forth are of them, and, you know, all of the issues of quality. And Airbus has got a change of control clause on the Airbus side of it. So there's no other bidders out there that I can see at the moment. I think the Spirit share price is potentially a very poor indicator of what the underlying value of this business will be as and when it's finally resolved.
Ron and Richard, anything you guys want to add to Spirit drama?
I think if you look at when Boeing threw them their last lifeline, it was $180 million, $200 million. I forget exactly what it was. Part of that agreement, and there was an agreement that you could access publicly, and I don't know if it, when it was all said and done, and if it changed, but part of that agreement was, in fact, if Spirit got sold, there could only be one buyer, and that is Boeing. So if there was a change of control, it would be Boeing. And then if there's a change of control, Airbus would have, a right to an option or whatever to do with their exposure. As you all know, it's pretty clean. Airbus stuff is, for the most part, geographically not located with the Boeing stuff. There's a little bit of overlap, I think, in Wichita, but not a ton. So we'll see. I fall in Sasha's camp on this one. We've written reports that we think it's a take under when it's all said and done. I mean, the reality is with Spirit, it's a factory. It's not a business. It's always been a factory and not a business. And I think that's part of the challenge with the you know, what's going on right now.
Right.
Why it's always been a challenging, you know, business to run is it's fun on a very fundamental level. It's a factory that was cut loose for, you know, we can, you know, talk about it why, but we don't have to right now. That was cut loose mistakenly, I would say, way back when.
Right.
And, you know, and then the real question becomes, and we've talked about, Boeing's going to do a new plane. Okay, fine. Well, that means the 737 goes away. That's really the only place where Spirit makes money. Then what's right. left of Spirit? You've got 787, which is important, but they don't make money there. On the Airbus stuff, they don't make any money. There is defense stuff that they actually do make money, right? Presumably,
right.
which is important. But there's not a heck of a lot left there once 7-3 goes away. So when you think about the terminal value of what is Spirit, what's it mean? Now, and I think this is important to understand too, this dynamic. There is a view among investors, however, bringing Spirit back into Boeing is so important to the performance enhancement of Boeing. If they were to overpay for it in the big picture, it doesn't really matter. So in the investment community, why has Spirit been bid up? I think the view is, you know, okay, so they pay a couple billion more for it, who cares? In the big picture of their operation, it doesn't matter. And there's probably validity to both sides.
It is fascinating to watch and follow this. That's all I have to say. And, you know, B-21, V-280, right? I mean, the company, CH-53, you know, a lot of work the company has been doing expanding its space role and certainly in weapons, precision weapons and hypersonics as well, right? I mean, so it's interesting the kind of growth they've seen on that side of the business. Richard, real quick, your take, because we want to go to Japan. We've only got a couple of minutes left and then end it with Ukraine. Go ahead.
Yeah, my colleague Kevin Michaels wrote a piece in Aviation Week about a year ago calling this a failed market. That is to say, first-tier aerostructures providers, they're just not a valid industry. You know, and I think this colors everything. I think it has to be absorbed by other people because everyone else in this market is either subject to the land of Japanese economics, long-term technology, et cetera, or, you know, like GKN sort of emphasizing engines and other specialized structures.
Right.
I think this has to go to other people. Now, the other thing is, of course, this also covers the Tom Gentile question. Boy, I mean, talk about a really tough job he had. I mean, I think everybody in that position would have had a hard time, a very hard time, just because, as my friend Kevin says, it's a failed market.
I think sort of, yes, I appreciate that. And everybody has a warm spot in their heart for Tom because he's a wonderfully decent man. The question is, right, I mean, the kind of production problems and the challenges they were having. And obviously, unfortunately, the way, you know, it manifested. Let's quickly shift gears because we're running short on time and we can come back on this issue as we have several times in the past. The speed with which Japan is changing is truly breathtaking. The country has dropped its arms export ban. This week, President Biden and Prime Minister Fumio Kishida met, struck a vow. I mean, it's hard to fully express all the stuff these two guys got done in the week that Kishida was in the United States, including, you know, an important meeting, you know, expanding the tripartite agreement between the United States, Japan, and the Philippines, right? And Japan is and South Korea have buried their hatchets, which is important in another deal the United States struck with the three. And now talk that Japan is going to join Australia, UK, US on the pillar two of that, the high-tech AI, quantum, hypersonics part of the agreement. Pillar one is still limited to the three countries on nuclear attack submarines. Japan is a key partner in the global combat aircraft program with the UK and Italy. And increasingly, there are folks making the case, look, this is as close of an ally as you can get, which is why this whole Nippon Steel thing is an absurdity. I think Nippon Steel should be allowed to buy U.S. Steel. There's no issue there. It's a commercial transaction from a trusted nation that's a close partner. We're sharing the most intimate defense technologies possible with the Japanese and our Japanese allies, including selling them F-35, Aegis combat system, and you name it. You know, I, honestly, on a $14 billion transaction like this, it's going to be good for American workers. But more broadly, we're talking about a first-rate manufacturing industrial power that has capacity, right? What's the role that Japan can and is going to be playing in this ecosystem? Because there's a tendency of sort of misunderstanding it as some pacifist shrinking violet. It's a country that's cognizant of its past, but it's actually moving forward in a very important way. What's the role in a defense industrial ecosystem when we're not able to satisfy our needs, but the Japanese are really good at innovating, really good at building things?
You know, I mean, Japan is incredibly important from a technology development standpoint. You know, first-rate engineering to be hugely important to GCAP, and maybe their AI prowess will also come in handy with collaborative combat aircraft integration, particularly for GCAP, but maybe other systems. There are so many ways they could help in missile defense. But in terms of bandwidth, which is really what the free world needs to resurrect that wonderful Cold War term, the free world needs industrial output, and they're not so great at that. I mean, they just don't have a lot of capacity to build at volume. You know, you've got South Korea playing a very big role in artillery shells, other countries like Turkey playing a role in industrial production, and that's all great. But Japan is not known for volume production of anything. They're known for technology.
Or I should say, right, I mean, aside from cars, which they produce around the world and a whole bunch of other products, but taking your point that on the defense industrial side, it has been extremely boutique production. And the way that they keep things going is they retire submarines a lot earlier than anybody else does. So they just keep building submarines, right? So their rate is industrial-based support driven, as opposed necessarily to, you know, volume production, right? It's about, you know, sustained expertise. Sash, your sense on whether or not Japan could play a role, and could Japan at some point play almost a Korea-like role, right? I mean, Hanwha and KAI are, you know, dynamic producers supplying Europe with arms at a time when European suppliers have been a little bit on the back foot on that. What's your sense in the role that Japan might be able to play in the next couple of years?
I mean, first of all, I think your criticism of Japanese industry for sort of focusing on stable production rather than looking at capacity and sort of keeping things ticking over, that's a criticism you could make of almost any Western industry in the last 25 years. You know, to survive, Western industry has had to be very, very good at lowish rates production compared to what we saw in the 1980s, 70s, 60s, because the demand wasn't there. Things have changed in the last 2 years. I think it's a big leap for Japanese or for Japan to go from where it is now to even where Korea has got to in the last 5 years or so. You know, Korean companies are now looking very clearly at doing quite significant acquisitions in Europe and the US, initially in naval systems, but almost certainly also in land systems. You're absolutely right. They've been very, very successful. Hanwha has in selling armored vehicles and artillery across Europe and also in Australia. And those are very, very demanding markets. Part of the challenge, I think, for Japan as well as for Korea is going to be how you can, at the same time, be a major exporter. I can see how they can be a partner. And I think they'd be a very, very valuable partner in GCAP and potentially in AUKUS. But how you can be a major exporter when at the same time you've actually got to rearm yourselves and focus on the threats you have at home. And my slight concern is that we end up having not a two-tier global defense market, but I mean a two-axis defense market where you have Europeans who are focused on Russia and you have Asian countries who are focused on China. And there will be or could be much less interplay between them because, comes back to your term, bandwidth. Most companies and most countries won't have the bandwidth to be able to do both. And particularly, for Europe, the demand in Europe is becoming so high that it's not just exports aren't so important anymore. They probably aren't a priority for a lot of nations anymore the way that they were 5 years ago. And by export, I really mean, you know, Middle East, Far East, from the point of view of Europeans.
Indeed, and I think Japan deserves credit because they've been supporting, well, whether it's the Philippines and a lot of other nations in the region with surplus Coast Guard equipment, right? I mean, they've been playing a growing role, and it's certainly going to be interesting to see the sort of the Trans-Pacific role that might also be able to play. I mean, anybody who's been had work done on a Japanese shipyard, right? I mean, there was the line all the time in the U.S. Navy that the best supported and the best conditioned carriers in the fleet or whatever carrier is forward in Japan. Midway was the oldest carrier, and to this day, folks will say, you know, it was in the best condition because of the meticulous care Japanese shipyard workers would. This is not a criticism of any American shipyard workers. I'm merely sort of expressing a long time story that was told in the fleet, especially in the Pacific fleet. Ron, your take really quickly, and then want to go to Sash on Ukraine and end it there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean a couple thoughts that, you know, it's a little bit of a rehash, but I mean, you know, A, on the technology front, a good partner to have. And B, regionally, a very important partner to have. So, I mean, it would seem, you know, strengthening the alliance with Japan, given, you know, the U.S. desire to project power in the Pacific, is, you know, kind of an absolute no-brainer. And, you know, I think Richard's point, you know, getting stuff in volume is maybe a different kind of challenge, but having, you know, a technically sophisticated ally, and in fact, maybe counter the volume point, if you look at, you know, the partnerships that they've done with engine production and some aero structures, they've actually been able to been very supportive as a supplier. So kind of, you know, all in makes a ton of sense to me.
Sash, we've got about a minute. Give us your sense on where we stand on the Ukraine war. I don't want to be a downer, but, you know, Europe isn't giving as much support as it needs. The U.S. is being slow in its support. It appears that we've hit the bottom of our strategic barrel on what it is we're willing to and can export, right? Immaterial of waiting for Congress. Unfortunately, losses start slow, and then they accelerate very quickly, and the Ukrainians now are really ringing the alarm. They have been ringing the alarm, but now they're saying the Russians are about to do an offensive, and they've been building up arms and manpower in order to do that. What's at stake? And what is it people ought to be remembering from military history about how things like this play out? We're going to be discussing this more on the program over the course of the week, but wanted to get your sense on this.
Okay, so I mean, something we've talked about before, but just to recap for our listeners, what does loss look like for Ukraine? Number one, Russia advances up to the line of the Dnieper River, retakes Kharkiv, and recovers all of the ground and more that they lost in various Ukrainian counterattacks in 2022 and 2023. Two, neutralizing Ukrainian air defenses such that the Ukrainians cannot have any impact on Russian drone attacks and cruise missile attacks over their major cities. And then possibly as a subset of that, establishment of Russian air superiority over Ukrainian territories. And then the last two would be neutralizing Ukrainian deep strike capabilities, drones, HIMARS, GLSDB, and the blockade of Odessa and other ports and restriction of grain exports. What's been really depressing about this week is the first three of those the Russians pretty much achieved. They are advancing at the moment. It's slow, it's unbelievably brutal, but they definitely have the initiative on the ground because they have got more material, period. They are neutralizing Ukrainian air defenses. The attack on Ukrainian power stations in the last couple of days have been absolutely brutal. That starts to impact the whole Ukrainian economy. Once you do that, you have a very, very damaging effect on the Ukrainian government and society as well. And use of glide bombs is effectively creating a degree of Russian air superiority over the front line that they haven't had before. So Ukraine is losing, and that means Europe is losing and the US is losing. And it's been, I think, the worst week I can remember in that regard, because it's been so one-sided. Europe is not supplying enough. I take issue with your idea that we've got to reach the bottom of the barrel. You've never reached the bottom of the barrel until you've actually exhausted all your supplies. The brutal fact is that it's a far better outcome to supply everything that we have got, we, Europe, US, to Ukraine, to get them to fight the battle for us, than it's going to be for us to fight the battle later. So we haven't reached the bottom barrel, but we think we have. We're being penny wise and pound foolish. And that is a very, very depressing situation to be in. Now, I see that Germany is supplying another Patriot battery to Ukraine, which is great. But the Ukrainian requirement is for not just systems, more Patriots, more RSTs, more CAM ER missiles, more NASAMS missile systems, but tons and tons, you know, hundreds of missiles. Because the Ukrainians, even where they have the missile systems, even where they can get the track on the target, they haven't got enough missiles to fire. So Ukraine is basically rationed to one incoming target, one missile. That missile hits or it doesn't hit. But air defense doctrine would suggest that you shoot, look, shoot, or even shoot, shoot, look. But if you're going to deal with a high value incoming target, you need to be firing multiple missiles. They don't have enough to do that. And that's our fault in Europe and in the West. And it's that is something that could be remedied, but not for as long as there's this talk about us reaching having reached the bottom of the barrel, because we haven't. We've still got stuff. We just think we need it for our own war, which is short-sighted, in my view.
I would say Joe Borrell is absolutely right, the EU foreign minister. He makes the case that Europe's got a lot of Patriot batteries. It's time for us to start shipping them over there. And Chris Cavoli, the Supreme Allied Commander, NATO Supreme Allied Commander, you know, points out throughout history, whoever has fewer bullets ends up losing. And it's important to get those bullets into Ukrainian hands. I mean, this is incredibly, as you said, Sash, penny-wise, pound-foolish. They've paid for it in their blood, and we have supported it with our treasure. And just because we're dumbasses, we're putting this poor country in a position of losing that which it fought so hard to get, as we've been on autopilot and focused on our own petty things. I understand French farmers and Polish farmers are important, but let's keep an eye on the big game here and what's going on. Everybody, thanks very much. Absolute pleasure. Hope everybody has a great what's left of the weekend. Has a great week. Look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks so much. Thanks to all of you for listening. And a quick reminder to check out our award-winning weekly podcast, Cavas Ships, hosted by Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace, who clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with Laura Winter, sponsored by TE Connectivity, who takes a thoughtful look at all things space. And our Air Power podcast, sponsored by GE Aerospace, that I co-host with our very own JJ Gertler. We'll be back again tomorrow with the Look Ahead program. And joining us will be Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners, as well as Chris and Chris from the Cavas Ships podcast. We're going to take a look back at Navy League and what some of the important takeaways are going to be. Thanks very much. We'll see you again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.